Welcome back to Leads to Scale, a podcast from Social Media Week. I am your host, Toby Daniels. On this week's episode, we have Shiv Singh, co-author of Savvy, Navigating Fake Companies, Fake Leaders, and Fake News in the Post-Trust Era. Shiv is a true leader in our industry with 20 years in the digital space, most recently as SVP and Global Head of Innovation at Visa. During our conversation, we took a deep dive into his upcoming book and discussed the decline in consumers' trust in government and corporations, why it's so hard to trust platforms like Facebook, and why negativity is unfortunately good for business. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Leads to Scale on your favorite podcasting app, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. Hey, podcast listeners, thanks for joining. Today, I am joined by my very great friend, Shiv Singh, who, among many impressive things, is the co-author of Savvy, Navigating Fake Companies, Fake Leaders, and Fake News in the Post-Truth Era. Shiv, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you for having me, Toby. It's great to be on.
So first of all, Shiv, congrats on the book. I know you've put a ton of work into putting the book together, a book that I believe you have co-authored with your wife, Rohini Luthra. I'm sure that's been an exciting collaboration among many other collaborations that I know you have in your life. There's a lot to cover in the book. Obviously, it's dense. It's full of incredible insights, but I want to sort of start with something that you stated very early on in the book in regards to the fact that both you and Rohini are sort of optimists and that you believe that human goodness will overcome the challenges that we're experiencing in a post-truth era. So let's start here and give our listeners some background kind of, you know, on you and the journey that led you to, you know, leaving a big corporate gig working for Visa to then ultimately writing this book.
Yes, of course. So, you know, Toby, the story of this book actually goes way back to 1999 when, and I'm aging myself, when I entered the workforce. You know, that was the first dot-com boom. It was a really exciting time for anyone who was thinking about the internet and the power of technology. And I entered the workforce with incredible techno-optimism. Only to barely 2 years later see it all come crashing down, and it was traumatic in many respects. I was working for a digital agency, Razorfish at the time, which is in fact when we first met when I was at that agency. However, then for the next 10-15 years, you know, from the ashes of that dot-com bust, the promise of the internet and the promise of this incredible technology change, you know, really started to come to life, and we've all seen it and experienced it. You know, the smartphones played a very big role in it. Web 2.0 played a massive role in it. The ability to share information, YouTube and video did an immense amount. And then of course, Facebook and Instagram. During this period, I went back to graduate school after working for many years and studied information theory and how information travels on social networks. And this was at the London School of Economics in London. Coming out of that, I then advised a lot of large companies and also wrote the book Social Media Marketing for Dummies, which was translated into 10 languages, had four different editions, did incredibly well. That then led me to working for PepsiCo, where I wanted to take my learnings and my insights and my experiences working across many different companies to one company and go really deep. And that in turn led to, you know, being able to drive the digital efforts for three Super Bowl campaigns, a whole bunch of global Pepsi campaigns and the like. That then led me, and I'm going to come right back to your question, it then led me to Visa, where I had the opportunity to launch the new brand platform and really work in a company that was going digital to the core. Payments was going digital to the core. You know, I had immense fun and thrill working at PepsiCo, but fundamentally, you know, the company is still a physical goods company and a CPG and will always be. Now, through all of this time, I was a wonderful techno-optimist. I thought technology was changing the world for the better in massive ways. I thought our children's lives were going to be much better as a result. I looked back at my life in 99 or my parents' lives when they were growing up, and I felt we were in a much, much better place thanks to technology. And, you know, living in Silicon Valley, without a doubt, I was a part of that whole Silicon Valley bubble. But then something happened. And what happened was, with all this amazing technology, and specifically the social media ecosystem, the platforms, we all started to see, and I started to observe myself, how it was being weaponized and how it was being used to spread misinformation and false truths and lies, and quite frankly, allowing and enabling terrible things to happen on them. You know, through no fault of the platforms themselves, but they were being weaponized. That's what eventually made me sit back and through many conversations with Rohini as well, really realize that we cannot look at this wonderful social media future simply through the lens of optimism and naively. We have to recognize with any major technological transformation and evolution comes costs as well. And we have to be mindful of those costs, and we have to mitigate against them. And that's really what this book is about. It's as much a journey of my own growth and my co-author's own growth through the last 30 years. And then the recognition that we all, as regular people in the world, have to be mindful of what the technology can do to us. And with that information, then know how to get the best out of it and protect or inoculate ourselves from the downsides.
So let's break savvy down. Having obviously read the book, there were definitely a few chapters that really resonated with me and that I think also will be of interest to our listeners. An early chapter, The State of Trust in 2018, I think is a good place to start. And in that chapter, you reference Edelman's Trust Barometer, which is a report that they put out every year. I think they put it out for like 18 years consecutively. And it's a report that like looks at trust based on research that they do with tens of thousands of consumers around the world, looking specifically at people's trust in regards to government and corporations. And the 2017 report was particularly interesting because while we have seen, I think, a consistent level or a consistent decline in trust over time, 2017 was the biggest decline that we've seen recently, or at least since the report first started coming out. And within that, I think, were some fairly startling facts in regards to consumers' trust in government and corporations specifically. So talk a little bit about that and why you kind of started the book in regards to looking at this report specifically, and just in general, why do you think we are seeing such a steep decline in trust today?
Yes. So, you know, it's really interesting that when we talk about trust, firstly, we all have different definitions of trust, and I'm going to come back to that in a moment. The second thing is, you know, with the Edelman Trust Barometer, which I strongly urge everyone to follow, and I've been following it closely over the last 20 years. In 2017, there was a sharp decline, especially in the US, a decline by something like 10 points. And one could argue that in 2017, you know, the global declines were tied to Brexit in the UK, the Syrian crisis, Russia meddling in Ukraine, and here in the US, all the noise around the 2016 US presidential election. But those same declines held steady in 2018. What that means is people did not start trusting governments or companies or the media or non-government organizations anymore. What then also happened, if we move forward to 2019, where the 2019 results just came out, those numbers, by and large, have stayed the same as well. The hard reality is we are increasingly in a world where we do not trust the institutions that have, for the longest of time, been our protectors in many ways, whether it has been our government or the media who we depend on getting news and information, or the businesses who would give us jobs and provide us income, or even the non-governmental organizations, the NGOs, who would support society in very different ways. We don't trust like the way we used to. But it's also a bit of a contradiction, because just as we don't trust these organizations, and this is not just the Edelman Trust Barometer, it's also Reuters does a 70,000 consumer piece of research. They saw the same results, same with a few other studies. But the interesting thing is, just as we don't trust these organizations, we at the same time are still willing to trust strangers when we get into an Uber, or when we go and stay at an Airbnb or give up our homes as an Airbnb. So there's a tension between trust in large organizations, trust in authority figures, versus trust in each other. Now, if we are to dig into this a little deeper, there are a few things I want to share. So firstly, the hard reality is we all have actually different definitions of trust. No one likes to talk about this. We use the word trust an incredible amount. We throw it around any opportunity we get, but we all have different definitions. There are also different definitions by language. To give you an example, in Norwegian, there really is no noun that corresponds to the English definition. In French, the word trust simply means to have confidence in something. The Japanese did not even have a definition for the word trust until a century ago. And and their meaning is really just the belief that someone or something is honest. So we all have different definitions. If you were to ask, or we were to ask the listeners of this podcast to define trust, I'm willing to get that. We would actually get 10 or 20 or maybe even 100 different definitions. So with the complexity around us not trusting, us not being clear on what trust even means, it then leads to the question of how did we get here and what really is trust? So what we talk about quite extensively in the book is how we define trust. And we use Morten Deutsch, who, for those of you who know and have studied psychology, as my co-author Rohini has, he's considered the father of modern day research on trust. And he defines trust as the confidence that one will find what is desired from another rather than what is feared. It's as simple as that, but it's very important. We're increasingly in a world where we don't have confidence that we will get back from businesses what we want from them versus what we fear from them. And the same applies to governments and the media as well. That's the harsh, harsh reality of the world we live in today. So that then leads to the next question, and this goes back to what you were asking me. Why now? How did we get here? We can't simply blame the 2016 presidential election and Brexit and Syria and Russia meddling alone for it. There's something else at play. And that is the reality that we all live in, where we have so much information at our fingertips. You know, we all know the amount of information produced in the last 2 years alone is greater than all the information that had been produced until that point in time, ever. So we have an amazing amount of information that's being produced. We're also consuming so much more information than we ever have. I mean, you know the stats better than me in terms of how much time we spend with our smartphones, looking at our feeds, whether they're on Facebook or Instagram or on the news. With all of that, there's an interesting phenomenon that's happened. We have so much information we're consuming. We're consuming what we want to see, which is often in our news feeds, which is prioritized based on what we like to read, that we're invariably only reading more and more information that we like versus what's good for us. It's nearly as if we have too much information candy and not enough information broccoli. And with that comes this idea of us, each of us living in our own echo chambers and not knowing what another person may think and not knowing what a different point of view may be. And when we come across a different opinion, how to deal with that. And when we don't know how to have those conversations or those debates around different opinions because we've gotten used to everyone agreeing with us and liking what we say on a social media platform, that's when we start to struggle with trusting others. And that coupled with the fact that it's very hard to tell what is news and what is fact and versus fiction, it all leads to this crisis in trust, which the Secretary General of the United Nations in September 2018 said very well when he said that we have a trust deficit in the world today.
You know, it reminds me of Social Media Week's theme. I think it was like maybe 2 or 3 years ago, which was Upwardly Mobile, the rise of the connected class. And within that, we were looking specifically at the sort of like the three steps towards information access. Step one is kind of to do with the technological kind of infrastructure necessary to be able to enable step two, which is all about kind of devices and software that enables communication and enables you to kind of connect to and access information online. And step three, which of course is the one that isn't really sort of talked about and not much investment really kind of goes into, which is to do with digital literacy and to do with like, how do we educate people to sort of think about accessing, as you say, more broccoli and less candy in regards to the information that they consume. And that's something that I actually want to come back to kind of later on in the conversation when we sort of think about this book and what you really want this book to do for people. But I do want to ask one question, though, about kind of like the developing world, because what's really interesting about the Barometer study is that I think that there is an increase in terms of trust as it pertains to trust in governments and corporations in a number of developing countries and in China and India in particular. I'm just wondering whether you have like an opinion or any insight to share in regards to why you think that's the case.
Yes, so I would say, you know, China and India they both have high levels of trust, much higher than here in the US. They are for very different reasons, as they are also very different, dramatically different countries. So, in the case of China, what's driving it more than ever is this optimism that it's China's century, that what is going on in China is increasingly driving the world. And whether that comes to trade relations or military might or just the strength and power of companies like Alibaba and Tencent, Chinese consumers and people in general believe their country is on the rise. They actually credit their government for it. They're incredibly proud of their business successes, especially if you consider where they were barely 30 or 40 years ago. And they, by and large, trust the media as well, because it's a good story. It's a good time. So that optimism is driving a lot over there. In the case of India, there are some similar themes, but probably the biggest driving factor is that the country is very young in terms of population. So it's 1.1, 1.2 billion people. The average age is around 25, 26. There's been a lot of prosperity, similar to China, and a lot of sudden access to cell phones and to satellite TV and to cars and motorbikes and the like. So there's increased prosperity. And again, it's also a country that suddenly appeared on the world map in the last 2 decades. So that's driven a lot of optimism. Now, the difference with India, I would say, is that Indians, by and large, are generally an optimistic people and a trusting people. So they typically score surveys high as well. And I can say this with a lot of confidence, having grown up in Asia and spent a fair time in India. But young, new economies that are on the rise has significantly more optimism. And even if we look at the U.S. numbers of the survey, and this again correlates to what I've seen with all kinds of other research, the more well-off a person is and the more their personal life is going, the way it's going in terms of prosperity, the better it is, the more trusting they are of the institutions around them. And that's very much what we see in the case of India, China, and the United Arab Emirates as well.
Is it not true, though, that what you're really sort of describing is not just like optimism, which is sort of dressed up as trust, but instead we're really talking about blind optimism or blind trust in the sense that they probably have similar levels of you know, that they probably feel the way that you felt in kind of late 99, early 2000 about the promise and the potential of something that has so much to give and create so much opportunity. And they haven't necessarily experienced the things that you've experienced. So therefore, that they're, while optimistic, they're blindly optimistic about the future. Is that a fair way of looking at the situation? And so only time will tell in terms of like, how that level of optimism might ultimately change over time?
You know, Toby, unfortunately, I think you're right. Especially in the case of India, where there is a lot of, it is indeed idealism and to a certain extent, naiveness driven. You know, people aren't worried or thinking about their data and their privacy. They aren't really thinking about whether big businesses and corp and the government has their best interests at heart. It's not as much in their consciousness as it is for us out here today. And truthfully, they also haven't had to deal with similar scandals on the scale that we have recently, whether that is, you know, credit card data, you know, Marriott being the most recent example of data leakages from, or data being hacked from companies, or the Facebook Cambridge Analytica issue. So yes, without a doubt, I think there's a bit of naive optimism at play as well, similar to what I personally experienced some time ago here in the States.
Yeah, no, definitely. We could spend like pretty much the entirety of this conversation kind of like talking about this. And in many ways I would like to, but there's lots to cover. So moving on, let's talk about Facebook. And let's talk about trusting Facebook. And I guess more broadly, let's talk about social media. So, you know, Facebook as one of the many social media platforms out there is obviously and definitely culpable on a number of different levels in regards to how it has acted. Its algorithms, the way that people access information, the way that news is delivered to them, the way that news propagates and information distributes on these platforms is to a certain extent, you know, under the control of Facebook and its technologies. And so, you know, I think it's fair to point criticism at Facebook, but in many ways, I think it's also fair to say that they're getting kind of a disproportionate amount of the blame. Would you agree with that? Or do you think that because of the size of Facebook, they need to be front and center in regards to kind of how we think about fixing the problem?
So I would say, yes, Facebook definitely does carry some blame. I don't think it was intentional or malicious by any means, you know, what Facebook allowed to happen on their platform. And it is easy to forget the immense amount of good that Facebook has done directly and what their platform has enabled as well. Having said that, there I think a few important things for us to consider. One is, and this might be turning into a theme of our conversation, Facebook suffered from that same naivete that we were talking about, in that they saw themselves simply as a platform and not an arbiter of what is the truth or what is fact and what is fiction. As soon as you have an algorithm, and as soon as you're making an algorithm-driven call on what people see and don't see, you're as much a media property as anyone else. You have editorial responsibility. That editorial responsibility may be through an algorithm, that's fine, but it's still a responsibility. And I think with that, Facebook maybe missed the boat a little bit. So that's, well, I'd say they did miss the boat. That's the first thing I'll say. The second thing, which is also important to mention, and for all my fellow, you know, business leaders out there and marketers and innovators, and especially those directly tied to the social media marketing space, we all carry a responsibility as well. You know, over the last decade, I've probably moved hundreds of millions of dollars. I know it has been hundreds and millions of dollars collectively over to Facebook for Facebook advertising. At no point, anytime I was signing those, you know, orders for buying the media on Facebook, did I question or did I ask about the data practices? Or did I ask about, you know, whether the consumer data was safe or whether the algorithms were strong enough, whether Facebook was really thinking hard about all the different implications of what was happening and what was being allowed on their platform? And I say this because it is easy to blame Facebook today. And the New York Times is doing a lot of that. In fact, I saw a really interesting analysis that just showed the number of negative stories that they've been publishing about Facebook over the last 6 months. But we all carry a responsibility in this space. We all have a voice. And, you know, these platforms, their business model is driven by advertising, by the folks like us who move money onto their platforms. We, too, have a job to hold them accountable and to interrogate and ask the right questions. And I think we fell short in that. So that's the second thing I would say. The third is, you know, whether it's in Europe or here or in Asia, I would suggest that the government was sleeping at the wheel as well. Yes, some basic regulation is required and should be in place, and probably should have been in place many years ago. The whole idea that companies can just do immense good and the best thing is to let them go and do their own thing doesn't really apply when you're talking about platforms that have such great influence on our lives and on such massive scale.
You know, it's the government regulation thing, I think, is interesting. And it's a challenge because, you know, we've been in the thick of it. We've been at the center of this industry, you know, for 10, you know, 20 years, we've been sort of part of and have contributed to you know, how it's grown. We've been, you know, centrally involved in the development of the tools and technologies. And despite that, even we have sort of found ourselves in a situation where we've looked back and gone, we literally didn't know, or we could never have known, or we didn't know what was happening at the time. And yet we look to government and we say, well, you know, you should have been maybe on this a little bit more quickly, or you should have worked with us to kind of regulate aspects of this industry earlier than you necessarily did. And the challenge there is it's really hard to regulate something that you don't fully understand or have no kind of comprehension of. And, you know, unfortunately, the people who represent us publicly as part of government really don't understand technology, never have. And until we see a significant demographic shift in ultimately who represents us at government, I doubt that's necessarily going to kind of change anytime soon. But again, you know, this is an opportunity to digress, and I'll try and keep us focused as we sort of move forward. You have touched on something in regards to Facebook, that a question that I ask of a lot of people, and this is not, you know, necessarily criticism that I'm kind of aiming at Facebook, because I think I'm with you in regards to kind of like what their sort of best intentions ultimately were. But I the one thing I do kind of have, I take issue with, and this is not just a Facebook issue, this is an issue that relates to most of the technology platform companies that have like idealistic kind of views of the world or idealistic visions that they're trying to fulfill. And it's also true of like media companies as well, which is that they have business models which are fundamentally at odds with their, you know, oftentimes very idealistic missions, right? Facebook's updated mission is, you know, is to sort of bring people closer together, which is great. Mark, obviously, something I think you quoted in the book is that like Mark is, you know, singularly focused on on building community or helping to build a community, which is fine. And I think that's great. And it feels very idealistic, but it is at odds with, and I don't think you can make a strong argument against this, with their business models, which is ultimately to exchange data for money, which is obviously an oversimplification of how they make money. But you know what I mean? So can you talk to that? I think it's just like such a pertinent question to much of what you cover in the book, but also something that I think gets discussed a lot, but isn't necessarily sort of fully understood in our industry.
Yeah. So Toby, I'd say there are a few things there, and I'm not sure if I'm going to put my head in the crocodile's mouth. I'm not sure if I completely agree with you, because the idea that they're a company that whose mission is at odds with how they make money, you know, you could draw a parallel to the TV industry, which is of course still much, much larger, where yes, they give us news, but they make money by selling, sure, not as deep, not as smart, but basically audiences to advertisers. The business model is not unique to Facebook that they have. I would also argue that their business model was not hidden to their consumers. Their consumers knew, and if you go back in time to, you know, 2012, 2013, their users knew that they were seeing ads that were personalized to them based on how they were using Facebook, and that those ads is what was allowing Facebook to be free. Now, one could argue that, oh, but those users didn't really know all the many, many ways in which their data was being used. But arguably, that also applies to Twitter, that also applies to Apple, that applies to Comcast, that applies to every technology company today. I say this not because, you know, I'm giving a Facebook a complete pass on this, but these are broader questions that aren't specific to Facebook alone, which is why, you know, a little bit more government guidance or regulation, similar to what's happening in Europe, and I think very effectively, is required. Yes, Facebook is a data business. The data business side of it actually serves to help the users. They get better advertising. Yes, there are issues when that data leaks, which it shouldn't, and that was a huge problem with Cambridge Analytica. But it's all of this is not unique to them. And that's why, you know, I also mentioned Marriott, and we could go back and talk about Target as well. In the case of Marriott, 500 million user accounts got hacked and stolen. And those included credit card and passport and social security information. Arguably, much worse. But we're not talking about that today. So my point is, yes, it's a data business. I don't think it's a complete surprise. It shouldn't be a complete surprise to anyone. These are more macro problems or questions that government, with the platform, with NGOs, with media authorities, with all of us together, you know, with folks like you, have to come together and solve for appropriately.
I think I largely agree with you, and maybe I didn't frame the question correctly, because I think where I was sort of trying to go with it is more sort of speaking to the issue of trust. Right. So if you're asking, let's say, a user of Facebook to trust Facebook, You're also having to ask that user to say, okay, what do I think Facebook believes is more important, its mission or how it makes money? And you know, is Facebook ultimately willing to do something in the best interest of its users in regards to establishing and deepening trust with its users in exchange for the opportunity to make more money? That's where I think it comes down to a question of trust and where trust in the context of obviously what you talk about and write about in your book makes for kind of a really interesting discussion and debate. And by the way, I completely agree with you. Every technology company, every media company, every entertainment company, they're all basically like facing similar sorts of issues. I mean, some of the biggest issues that like, let's say the entertainment industry or the television business faces today is the fact that like, and actually this is true of Hulu as well, where you've actually got people, you know, who are subscribing to access premium content while also being served ads at the same time, which obviously, you know, doesn't feel right. And something that ultimately is going to kind of like negatively impact a consumer's sort of, feelings about that particular kind of service. Feel free to sort of like, you know, comment or add something to that. Otherwise I'll just move on.
Yeah. You know, one quick thing I do want to mention, you touched on digital literacy early on in our conversation. And, mm-hmm. and I think that is an area where, I think Facebook will recover from this and they'll do the right thing, just so that you know my sort of opinion. And, mm-hmm. and I still have a lot of confidence in them. But I think one area where they definitely fell short, as did many other media and tech companies, is around digital literacy. They, just as they went to immense lengths to educate marketers on how to use the platform and meet their business objectives, they should have gone to those same lengths to educate consumers on how their data was going to be used and the privacy policies and the privacy settings. Now, yes, they did some things, and that is good, but I would suggest that they could have done more, and they're starting to do that now, and I hope they'll do a lot more in the future.
We interrupt this week's episode of Leads to Scale to share an update in regards to our forthcoming conference in London, the 10th annual edition of Social Media Week London, Europe's premier conference for media and marketing professionals, is taking place at the QE2 Conference Center in Westminster between October 31st and November 1st. This year's event will continue the 2019 global theme Stories with Great Influence Comes Great Responsibility, a conversation that will explore how social media has become the most influential story platform in the world that has the power to both unite and divide us. Check out our first wave of speakers and secure your pass by visiting socialmediaweek.org/London. And don't forget to use the code LEADS2SCALE at the checkout to save an additional 10% off your pass. All right, let's get back to the show.
So let's talk about, I agree, you know, by the way, and it's interesting to see some of the kind of initiatives and some of the things that like Facebook is willing to put money behind or grants it's issuing and you know, funds that it's committing to. But, you know, where does or should digital literacy start? It has to start, obviously, in terms of how we educate our kids. And I don't believe enough has been done in that regard. And I think it's a huge area of opportunity. And I also believe, and I believe this very strongly, particularly coming off the work that we did with Upwardly Mobile, the Rise of the Connected Class a few years ago, I think it's really important in the developing world where you have people obviously connecting with, as we've already talked about, an enormous amount of kind of like blind faith and optimism, connecting for the first time via mobile devices. And you know, with a lack of education, a lack of digital literacy, that's obviously going to kind of lead to problems down the road. Let's talk about another chapter in the book, Repetition Makes Truth. And you specifically touched on something called the illusionary truth effect. illusory truth effect. So talk about like what is this and how is it relevant to what we're talking about?
Yes, of course. And this is, one of those cases in the book where when you read it, you're like, oh, yes, that makes total sense. But you don't think that until you read that. It's mm-hmm. sort of it feels obvious after the fact.
Yes.
So firstly, just to share a quick anecdote, the first known example of the illusory truth effect goes way back to the Punic Wars, you know, centuries ago when Rome was fighting Carthage. They had three wars against Carthage. They won the first two, but then Carthage, you know, which was based in Northern Africa, was still trying to get control of the Mediterranean and started needling the Roman Empire again. When that happened, a lot of Romans felt, oh my gosh, we've gone to war twice. It's been an exhausting effort. We can't stomach going to war again. It's like we have other priorities and the rest of our empire to care about. However, there's one senator in Rome, Senator Cato, Cato the Elder, and he really wanted to start another war with Carthage. And the way he did it, and this is a fascinating thing, the way he did it was any speech he was giving in the Senate, he could be talking about the drainage system in Rome, he could be talking about the weather or farming, or he could be talking about whatever it may be, he'd end it by saying, and Carthage must be destroyed. And he'd say that again and again. Over time, everyone started to believe that and agree with him. And Rome did go to war again against Carthage, and Carthage was destroyed. So that's the first example of the illusory truth effect. The basic meaning is that the more you repeat something, repeated exposure leads to people believing it more, not just remembering it, but actually believing it more and more. And this is really important to keep in mind in the post-trust era, because when we think about how we consume news, what news we're consuming, the more we see a headline, whether it's in social media or elsewhere, when we see it again and again, we actually start to think, oh my gosh, maybe that is true. So that's what the illusory truth effect is. It's in every part of our lives. In social media, thanks to the echo chambers and the way the algorithms work, we see it even more. And that's why we find ourselves in a world where two different people who are, you know, have the same levels of education, are similar in every respect, but can have opposing views on the very same subject. The illusory truth effect may have played a role in that.
And of course, we're seeing this play out in fairly significant ways right now with Donald Trump and all of his attempts to be able to convince people of things that are obviously not true. And what's interesting, I think, about the illusory effect is it's not just a case of like how often you repeat something, but it also seems to me that like the nature of what you're saying, not just how often you say it, but the nature of what you're saying, the content itself is also really important, particularly when you think about how information travels through social media. The more shocking and outrageous the statement, the more likely it is, the more likely it will be shared. And it seems, and this is the saddest thing, the more likely it will be picked up in mainstream media. So, you know, and that sort of segues nicely into the next chapter of your book, Why We'd Rather Be Negative, because this, I think, sort of touches on, why certain types of information is shared over other types of information. And you talk about negativity and specifically why negativity actually can be good for business. Talk about kind of some of your findings that you came across through your research that sort of supports this idea that like negativity and negative information, you know, travels farther and wider than positive news.
Sure. So a few things, but before I jump into that, you know, one last thing on the illusory truth effect. You're absolutely right about our president. And you know, he's a phenomenal marketer because he capitalizes on this phenomena. And probably a great example also is how he coined the phrase "Crooked Hillary" and just used it again and again. And that was both the sensationalism of it and the repetition of it that made it really stick with people. So when it comes to this whole idea of the negativity bias, and we'd rather be negative, there are a few really interesting things. So the first point that I'd like to draw attention to is this wonderful, wonderful study that Deb Roy at MIT led last year. And it was published in the Science magazine and in the New York Times and a few other places. He did an analysis of 126,000 news stories that were tweeted by 3 million people, roughly 4.5 million times over a 10-year period on Twitter. So he analyzed all these news stories, figuring out when and why they were being tweeted. What he discovered was that the fake stories, the fake news, and especially the more negative ones, spread much more and to a factor of, you know, 70% times than the true stories. So the fake news traveled much more on Twitter than the real news. Added to that, which was also very interesting, is that the fake news wasn't being spread by bots or Russian agents or foreign actors, but by regular people who saw the headline, loved the sensationalism of it, chose to believe it because it supported a pre-existing worldview that they had or that they believed because through repeated exposure, and they were spreading it themselves. And this leads to a really fundamental point that we make in the book, which is that we ourselves as regular people, you know, Main Street America, we ourselves carry responsibility in this fake era. And as we carry responsibility, it is on us, on each and every one of us, to inoculate ourselves so that we can fight the fake news, the fake companies, and the fake leaders much more strongly. So that's one example. Another example to quickly mention is what psychologist Daniel Kahneman has seen in his research, which is all about that people have a much stronger reaction when they lose $50 versus when they're given $50. It has a much more visceral, emotional reaction to them. And really what that leads us to is that the bottom line is our mind reacts to bad things much more powerfully than it does to the equivalent good things. And that's what we mean by the negativity bias. And that's why we have to be extra careful whether it's with sensationalist news headlines or water cooler conversations in the company or, you know, having knee-jerk reactions to what a leader may or may not say. And a great example of that is this weekend with that Lincoln Memorial controversy with those students from that Catholic school. We all saw a mini clip of the video, and many of us had a very strong negative reaction to what happened and assumed it was, you know, all kinds of bad stuff. When the full clip came out, it actually became much harder to discern whether those students were, you know, really bullying or intimidating that American Indian. So these issues aren't as clear as they may seem on the surface. And we have to watch for our tendency to lean into the negative sensationalist side.
You make a really great argument in the book that we are also too trusting of new technologies, and in particular, we're sort of blind to the potential implications of artificial intelligence, and how it will play a role in distributing false information in the future. Can you talk about that? Like, do you have major concerns? I mean, you touch on a few of them, and certainly there are some sort of, warning signs that we're already starting to see. But perhaps can you give some examples of, like, where you see this as a problem today and really sort of how we should be sort of better educating ourselves, particularly as we sort of think about AI in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is, I think, a massively important subject and something that I don't think they're talking about enough. And I was truthfully really disappointed at CES, where we weren't having enough conversations about responsible AI. So I'm going to give you two examples, and then we can talk about it more generally. So the first example comes from China and their social credit score. The social credit score, and whoever's not familiar with it, I urge you to Google it and read up on the social credit score. It's something that's been introduced in a few cities in China with the intent of rolling it out nationally. Think of it as, just as we have financial credit scores out here and in Europe, think about this as a financial credit score, but one that is broader, that includes practically every part of your life. It's a score that captures, of course, your financial well-being, but also your behavior in society, everything from the number of parking and speeding tickets you've gotten, to whether you've been paying all your bills in time, to whether you have or have not been littering the streets, to how you've been behaving, in your kid's school or in a corporate setting, whatever it may be. It captures data about you in every single part of your life, including how much time you spend playing video games late at night. What it does with that data is it then assigns you a score, a trust score. And with that trust score, the government then determines whether your children get to go to private school, whether your children or you get to travel on aeroplanes, whether you get eligible for those posh government jobs, whether you get certain benefits that may not be available to every other citizen. So this is, it's both fascinating and, in my personal view, massively frightening as well. It's when trust versus being a social contract person to person becomes data and technology driven, and where the algorithms make decisions on who you are for you, and therefore, based on that, assign what you get to do and what you don't get to do. We're moving into this AI-driven future where a lot more data on us will be shared with many, many more people or government organizations. We all have to be careful that everything doesn't become algorithmic-driven, and that it doesn't become out of our own control. That's the first piece. The second piece tied to this is, algorithms are fundamentally coded by human beings. Even those neural networks, they start off with human beings coding behind them and building them. As human beings, and we discussed this in the book, we all have our own biases and prejudices that we try to be conscious of and we try to fight. Because they're coded by human beings, they inherit those biases. And you can, for example, and I'm reluctant to talk about politicians because it can mean that I might agree with everything they say, which is not true. But Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez just on Monday said this very well when she said, there's a risk that the AI tools we have and will have in the future, that they could be racist. And that is true. That is a definite risk. So that's the world we're hurtling towards. it is on us to make sure that that does not happen, whether it be Big Brother social credit scores as in China, or AI engines that we use in our everyday that have bias built into them without any of us realizing it. So I'd say those are two big things for us to think about.
So let's spend some time talking about the kind of the next wave of technological innovation and the path towards, you know, the potential utopian future that we all hope we will be able to reach and fulfill. And let's talk about the blockchain specifically. So you have a chapter in the book called "Is the Blockchain the Future of Trust?" You talk about the blockchain and the various potential applications for how it can make technology and the distribution of information more trustworthy. So talk about how you really see the blockchain and sort of perhaps address some of the issues that that we've touched on in relation to social media that you think, you know, the blockchain could potentially, you know, help to address.
Yeah, so I'm a big believer in the blockchain, and that is because it's a technology framework that has more transparency and more broken up control than any other system that exists. Decentralized control, that was the word I was looking for. What's also incredibly powerful about it is it's visible, it's a visible log. So you cannot go back and re-edit it. So anything, you know, let's just take for a moment that social credit score in China once again. What makes it even more dangerous is the fact that no one truly knows how the algorithm works and what inputs go into setting that trust score. If it was blockchain driven, we all would be able to see our own records. We would see what built them, and no one else would be able to hack into them and change them. Now, this doesn't make me a fan of social credit scores, but it makes it a little bit better. An example of where the blockchain works incredibly effectively is with land records, where in a lot of developing countries, you often have land records that suddenly get messed with by corrupt officials. And you, as just a regular person living in your little house in a little village somewhere in the developing world, can wake up one morning and be told that, guess what? You actually don't own the house you thought you owned because someone would have gone and messed with the records. With the blockchain system, you cannot do that. So that's just one tiny example of how powerful it can be. In the context of social media, I think there are all kinds of applications for us to consider. So the first is, imagine if all our connections to each other were on a blockchain that we could then transport and use in any social media platform we liked. And it would be, because it was decentralized and because it would be public and private key driven, we could control what kind of access and what kind of use it would have. In an instant, I would be able to say, you know, use these 20 attributes about me when determining what advertising I see, but don't use my location, don't use anything I post about my kids. You know, I could set that, and then instantly across every social media platform, they would be able to follow those rules. And I would say, use my single friendship network across all of these social media platforms. So there are all kinds of positive ramifications and opportunities around it. Where it is more trusted than any other system is, one, it's a visible ledger, it's a visible data store. And then the second reason is, we ourselves as individuals can have control over our records. We can't go back and edit them, so they're very fact-based, but that's also a core attribute of trust. But we will know what it is, and we can unlock it for certain people as and where appropriate.
Do you have any concerns, Shiv? I mean, like, it sort of almost feels like every time there is a new wave of technological innovation, or when we can sort of start to kind of imagine or see a new technology infrastructure emerge, we tend to kind of like forget everything that has happened previously and sort of attach all of our hopes and dreams and aspirations and then most importantly our optimism to something that is new and has the sort of this promise and potential of being able to kind of address everything that the previous technologies failed to address, despite the fact that we had similar levels of kind of like optimism about those technologies, you know, as they were starting to emerge. So you know, can you see that happening? There's so much that's unknown about the future, of course, but can you see that happening? Are there any cracks in the blockchain? Even just like theoretical ones that you think that we should be concerned about or cautious in regards to you know, how much faith we put in this technology?
Yeah, so it's interesting, you know, the theory around blockchain and that you know, there were these three landmark papers that articulated the framework and the technology underpinning or the logic underpinning is incredibly sound. The challenge, though, is it's sort of, and this goes back to one of the core theses in the book, it actually goes back to how we use it, how we implement it, and what we do with it. So literally, Toby, everything we've talked about in this conversation can still apply in the context of blockchain. We can build applications and services on top of it that have bias built into them. And even though the core blockchain ledger could be, you know, pure as can be, everything around it that uses it can have a lot of problems because the data would be more accessible and more clean and more transparent. The opportunity to mess with it would be greater. Secondly, just as we can have a lot of bias still at play, we can also suffer from that question of digital literacy we talked about, which is people can give access to their data when they shouldn't. And because it'll be a more pure, more clean form that can be leveraged in many, many different places, it could actually be even more dangerous. So we need to be cautious there. Thirdly, and this is sort of how we as corporations, governments, and human beings approach technology, we can rush into it and see it as sort of the new you know, golden egg that's going to solve everything for us. And when we do that, we can forget about the costs that are included or that it takes when you're shifting from one technology framework to another. And we can spend a lot more money than we need to replace our existing digital infrastructure just because this feels like a slightly better solution. Mm-hmm. So all the usual issues we have whenever we look to embrace a new technology, I think would apply here as well. I think in the financial services space, they're being pretty smart where they're choosing discrete use cases, you know, sort of like cross-border payments between countries to test out blockchain before trying to say, it's going to solve world hunger for us. Let's try and use it for everything everywhere.
I think, by the way, the point you just made is not necessarily that I've heard being made as in such an articulate way. And I almost like urge you, when you think about kind of the promotion of this book and when you have an opportunity to touch on this chapter in particular, that you speak about that and you try and make that point, because I think it's just such an important one, because there is just, you know, there's just, you can just see it. It's palpable, the wave of enthusiasm as people jump on board to the next big thing without necessarily fully understanding, first of all, without fully understanding like what it is and what it consists of and what the potential is for how we can utilize it. But even more importantly, you know, highlighting and thinking about all of the things that we don't know about, you know, how it can be kind of, you know, utilized and used in the future. And there will always be bad actors, and bad actors will always find a way of being able to manipulate a system for their own political or commercial gain. I don't believe for a second that that's going to be in any way different in regards to the blockchain. And it's just, you know, it's important, I think, that we try and remain as objective, I suppose, about these things as possible.
I couldn't agree more.
So we're out of time, but I want to sort of wrap the conversation by sort of spending a few minutes just talking about how people can use this book beyond just purchasing it, reading it, listening to it, whatever. But beyond just that, like, what people really should be doing or thinking about in regards to how they can change their own behaviors, how they can change their own mindset in regards to trust, in regards to the post-trust era. And you know, one of the things that I love about the book is you know, within each chapter or towards the end of each chapter, you have this like Get Savvy Now section, which is really about sort of breaking down a lot of what, you know, the reader has just kind of consumed, and then providing them with some kind of actionable sort of steps towards sort of, you know, making change. So I guess, you know, talk about the Get Savvy Now piece of the book, but also talk about what you would ideally love for people to do once they've read the book, and maybe some sort of just general advice in terms of, you know, how they should be sort of, you know, applying some of the principles in the book.
Yeah, sure. You know, and so when Rohini and I conceptualized and wrote this book, it was built on the premise that we're in an era where we don't trust each other enough. And society and governments and the world works on trust. And it's on all of us together to reverse this era we're in and move back into a place where there were much more trusting relationships. Trusting relationships between neighbors, between employees and employers, among co-workers, between citizens and their local, state, and federal governments, between people and national news organizations and local news organizations across the board. We strongly and deeply believe we need to move to a more trusted era, if for nothing else, but for the sake of all of our children. The way we feel that happens is not just by putting blame on government or corporations or leaders or the media, but also looking introspectively at ourselves and seeing, what can we do different? How can we protect or inoculate ourselves from the fakeness around us? And how can we think about trust and establish, you know, more savvier relationships with each other and the world around us. And through the book and through the Get Savvy Now sections, and the book as a whole, we highlight these six human glitches, things like why we don't trust, why we fall for alternative facts, why we desperately want to belong and how that hurts us at times, why we want to be right and why that blinds us, why we bow to authority without realizing it, why we trust AI too much, to really articulate these are the human glitches, but they're solves and they're solutions, things that we can do. And many of that's in the Get Savvy Now section. And then we do all of this through real examples, whether it's talking about Travis at Uber or Duke Tran, the whistleblower at Wells Fargo, or Theranos in Silicon Valley, or what John F. Kennedy had to deal with during the Bay of Pigs, or Obama and Tesla, or villages in India and how they work on trust, to Facebook, of course, to Samsung in Asia. We use real-world examples from the last year and a half, headlines from the last year and a half, to explain what's going on in the world, to talk about our human glitches, and to then to share how we can each sort of work through them and lead better and stronger professional and personal lives.
It's a perfect way to end the conversation. But before we fully wrap, Shiv, why don't you let our listeners know where they can find more information about Savvy, and most importantly, where they will be able to purchase the book when, I believe, it is launched sometime in February.
Yes, and thank you for reminding me to do that. So the hardcover of the book comes out around the 14th of February. It'll be available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you know, at your favorite bookseller nationally and online, of course. The Kindle version has actually already come out and is available on Amazon. So if you're a Kindle reader, you can buy the book now. And if you read the book, please post a review on Amazon. And then I'm also, for the corporates, I'm also available for speaking engagements to unpack some of the themes in the book more deeply.
And we, of course, are incredibly lucky to have you speaking at our New York conference coming up in April, where I believe that you will also be talking about and referencing the book in your talk. So we're excited for that. We're hugely appreciative of the opportunity to have this conversation, Shiv. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Toby, and I can't wait for Social Media Week.
This has been Leads to Scale, brought to you by Social Media Week. For more information on how to get involved with future events, visit socialmediaweek.org. If you have a moment, please rate, review, and subscribe to Leads to Scale wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.